This is the State of Things. We are now at the American Tobacco Historic District, where we've been for years, and I'm still Frank Stacio, and I have a question for you. Do you know the first rule of the Fight Club?
The first rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club. The second rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club.
And there it is, a clip from the 1999 film. Interestingly enough, when the film was released, not many people did talk about the Fight Club. But after its release on DVD, it became a hit and a cult phenomenon. And, of course, before the film, there was Fight Club, the novel. And in it, a man and his alter ego named Tyler Durden create an underground recreational fight group. It was Chuck Palahniuk's debut novel in 1996. Since then, he's written more than a dozen other works. His latest, a sequel to Fight Club, it's a graphic novel called Fight Club 2. Last week, it reached number one on the hardcover graphic novel list for the New York Times bestseller list. Chuck hosts a book signing at Regulator Bookshop in Durham this afternoon, but first he joins me on the State of Things. Chuck Palahniuk, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Hey, hi. Hi, Frank.
Listen, what inspired Fight Club 2 as a graphic novel?
You know, Portland is home to a lot of graphic novel people, Brian Michael Bendis and Matt Fraction. And they basically ganged up on me and said that they would teach me this new storytelling form. I had the time and I had the coaching. And Dark Horse is right there in Portland also. I had the publisher, and that's how it happened.
So what did you learn, and how is it different from writing a novel and consulting on a film?
I learned how to imply emotion with still images. I learned how to keep my dialogue to a bare minimum. And most importantly, I learned that with every page turn, you've got to have a setup at the bottom of the right-hand page so that as the page is turned, you can have a payoff at the top of the left-hand page. And that makes comics the most heavily plotted storytelling form that I'm aware of. It's brutal.
Tell us about, but you're already famous for a kind of concise and spare literary style, a prose style. So did you have to change much to make it work for graphic novels?
I had to change a little bit. I really had to pare back the dialogue. Yeah. But my background is journalism. That's my degree. And so much of my writing is a kind of a journalistic form, you know, information chopped together in a very structured way.
Tell us about working with Cameron Stewart and his vision for the Fight Club world.
You know, with Cameron, it was a little bit of testing. There were things I wanted to do. I wanted to have an army of dying children. And Cameron was very squeamish about writing that, drawing that. I wanted to have the nuclear warheads sourced from Amazon.com. I wanted to have use a Zapruder film of the Kennedy assassination, but I wanted to splice some penises into it. And every time I suggested one atrocious idea after another, Cameron found some way to do it.
Well, he didn't find some way to talk you out of it, so that's interesting. But he found a way. So after that collaboration, clearly you have a vision. I mean, these are very graphic, very difficult images, but they're powerful and obviously necessary to you. Cameron, you're suggesting here, is wanting to temper this, but he puts it, but he gets it in. When you see that vision, when you see his version of that, how do you react?
I think he's done a terrific, terrific job. You know, my ideas are my ideas. And Cameron's the one that has to translate them into something that people will understand. And that's kind of the glory of graphic novels, is that unlike a movie, these things have a sense of cartoony unreality, and you can get away with a lot more. They're less literal than they would have to be for a movie.
So in this, in Fight Club 2, now the anonymous narrator gets a name, Sebastian. He marries someone we know from Fight Club, who is Marla, from the original story. Give us a sense of the plot now, and tell us a little bit more.
It's really 10 years later, after the end of the movie, and he has been married to Marla for 10 years, and they have a 9-year-old child. And so basically he's maintained this stable life by taking a huge amount of psychotropic drugs. But the drugs have made him a terrible, distant father, even a worse father than he felt his own father to have been. And he's also been a terrible husband because he's always zoned out on all of these mood equalizers and antidepressants and antipsychotics. And his wife, in order to save their marriage, Marla, begins to titrate his medications. And in doing so, she brings back the man we all know and love.
Tyler Durden. It's fascinating that, yes, she's the one who's instrumental in bringing Tyler back. He resurfaces and things start to unravel. There is a kind of continuation of the work that we might have seen beginning in the original, in Fight Club, right?
Right. And it unravels into the past as well as the future, because I wanted to take this one aberrant episode and stretch it into the past to show where it came from. And also stretch it into the future to show that it was not something that was going to go away, to create a kind of Stephen King or Neil Gaiman mythology out of the story we already know.
Did you have to, I mean, Tyler Durden acts and works, in my mind, as a kind of archetype as well as a character. But, I mean, there is an archetype that is resonant in Tyler Durden. Did you have to learn more about him as a palpable character and develop him differently for the sequel?
You know, I learned about him by researching other forms of that character, the traditional trickster character, and that would be Coyote in Native American culture, or Loki in Norse culture, or Hermes in Greek culture. So any trickster character is basically Tyler Durden, and he functions that way, and I think that's why he's been embraced so readily.
Yeah. Yeah, well, let me get philosophical with you for just a half a second here, if I can, and step back. The idea that there is a kind of, I'll call it an imaginal world, that is a reality that we can create that may not be objectively observable to everybody else, but that ultimately has observable effects. Do you know what I'm saying? That there is, it's true, it's real, and yet if three of us were in the room together, we might not all see the same thing. Do you buy into that notion that there is a thing that I'll call imaginal, real and yet not observable to everybody else, that has real effects and real impact on an actual observable world?
Boy.
Or is that just a lot of crap? You can say that. It's okay. Because you sold more books than I have. What?
We all have a different framework for how we perceive the world. A plumber walks into a different room than a painter walks into. We're all sort of attuned to different aspects of reality. And so I'll buy that. That's an important part about writing. But
the rest of it, that's just nonsense. Let me tell you. Let's go back to the clip. I'm going to get a clip from the film, 1999, an example of Durden and his philosophy. This is a scene where Durden and the narrator are talking in a bar after the narrator's apartment has been blown up. Let's listen.
We are consumers. We are byproducts of a lifestyle obsession. Murder, crime, poverty, these things don't concern me. What concerns me are celebrity magazines, television with 500 channels, some guy's name on my underwear. Rogaine, Viagra, Olestra.
Martha Stewart.
Martha's polishing the brass on the Titanic. It's all going down, man. So f*** off with your sofa units and string green stripe patterns. I say never be complete. I say stop being perfect. I say let's evolve. Let the chips fall where they may. That's me, and I could be wrong. Maybe it's a terrible tragedy.
No, it's just stuff. You know, my insurance is probably going to cover it, so.
The things you own end up owning you.
This is a clip from the 1999 film Fight Club. My guest is writer Chuck Palahniuk. His new book is the graphic novel Fight Club 2. He's at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham this afternoon. That was sort of the zeitgeist of the 90s, too, kind of tapping in on that anxiety about advertising and the sort of consumer culture that was consuming us all. Is that, do you think, what accounts or partly for the success of Fight Club?
He does, but it was something a lot of people were saying at the time. But the people who were saying it were not suggesting an alternative, which was, you know, where do you go if you're not collecting stuff? What do you do with your life if you're not putting together that perfect household and that perfect wardrobe? People weren't suggesting alternatives. And they also weren't suggesting social models for men. Women are fantastic about creating narratives in which women come together and talk about their experience. The sisterhood of the traveling pants, of the Joy Luck Club, of the Ya-Ya sisterhood, all those books. But there are so few books that show men coming together. The only two I can think of are Fight Club and Dead Poets Society. And in both cases, it's men coming together in an underground space and talking about their lives. But in Dead Poets Society, there's less mutual consensual punching.
So, was that something you were conscious of and was an intention for you in writing Fight Club, or is that something you sort of noticed after the fact?
It wasn't a deliberate intention, because my theory is that reading is such a solitary pastime that people want to read stories in which they see people together in a new form of community, so that when they go back into community, they have a different way of being with people. And another term, I wanted to rewrite The Great Gatsby, because in Gatsby, we have a suicide, and we have a murder, and we have a witness. And so I wanted to merge the suicide and the murder, and in doing so, integrate Tyler and the narrator and create the witness. So it's basically a Campbell's Soup condensed version of Gatsby.
There is a culture and a community now around Fight Club. What do you see as your role in that? Do you just send it off into the big wide world and let it go, or do you want to play an active role in cultivating that community?
You know, my active role is to support people in writing, and when I'm online, when I'm interacting with people, I like to make the focus about writing and what I've learned from people and passing that along as quickly as possible so that people's writing benefits from it as well.
We're talking about Fight Club too, and the original, when you talked about Fight Club, the zeitgeist of the 90s, this anxiety over consumer culture and not figuring out how to get outside of the system. How have things changed, and do you think Fight Club 2 sort of speaks to what we see now in the kind of political, cultural milieu? I mean, how has that changed, and does Fight Club address any of those changes?
Boy, huge questions.
We ask the big questions here because we got time yawning at us forever. It's summer.
One aspect of it, and just one aspect, is the fact that when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, it seemed like the world was constantly involved in conflict. It was the Vietnam War. It was the Basque separatists. It was the IRA. It was Patty Hearst. It was the kidnappings. It was everything. It was Newark and the Watts riots. It was violence unending. And yet people were constantly demanding peace and saying that eventually we would arrive at peace. And here I am, 55 years old, and things are worse than they were when I was a child. It's amazing. And so I think humanity has to come to terms with the idea that maybe humanity really loves conflict. Mm. We are addicted to conflict, and that we enjoy the hell out of conflict. And that's something I wanted to explore in this book.
You wrote yourself into Fight Club too. There's a kind of a lot of meta examples and kind of meta narratives that run through Fight Club too, including an appearance by yourself. Tell us more about why you formatted the story using this kind of meta filter.
Well, you know, on a real basic structural level, in comics, you need to be able to cut to a lot of different things. So, you know, we cut to a kind of dream reality. We cut to a flashback reality. We cut to a fantasy reality, we cut to different characters and their plot lines, and then ultimately we cut to this meta reality, so that with every page turn, we can be someplace different. And on another level, literary critics are really happy to point out the idea that Ken Kesey's asylum, his mental hospital, is based on his writer's workshop at Stanford when he was getting his MFA, and that Toni Morrison's plantation is probably most likely based on the writers, or populated by the writers that were in her graduate studies workshop. And so I wanted to very deliberately put my writer's workshop, the writers I work with, Chelsea Kane, Lydia Yuknovich, Monica Drake, to put them into the narrative so I could kind of play with that tendency of literary critics to blame the workshop.
I want to switch gears a little bit here because I know that you're coming out with an adult coloring book this fall, and I want to know about that and the process of expanding your work into that medium.
You know, the variant covers, you know, so many of the issues had different covers for different markets, and they gave me a chance to work with artists all over the world, fantastic illustrators. And I chose my favorite eight, and I had eight really outlandish short stories. So we contacted each of these eight artists and asked them to create, oh, say, from 6 to 8 different full-page illustrations that could be colored for each story. And also, I wanted the book to be oversized and hardbound and to be something really beautiful that would be worth the effort to color and to keep forever. It would really be more like an illuminated manuscript. And so it is these over-the-top, challenging stories with illustrations that make them even more extreme. Well, and that comes out October 25th from Dark Horse.
And in still other news, you're adapting your book, Lullaby, into a movie. Tell us about a little bit about the story and then your personal connection to the story and the development of the film.
A director named Andrew Mingo, who made a short film from my short story Romance and did a beautiful job of it. He has got the rights to Lullaby, and he put together a kind of an arrangement with Kickstarter and with the Sundance people and got the funding put together. And Andy plans to start shooting with a screenplay that I co-wrote in October. So October is a big month for me.
Yeah. And what about Fight Club 2? I mean, it seems inevitable that it would be a movie. Is that something that you're exploring?
Well, you know, that army of dying children is going to be impossible to make literal enough to film.
Not to mention the anatomical suggestion you made as well. I suppose that's hard.
Yeah. Which one?
but it's not these days. I mean, you know, I've heard you also talk about kind of the difficulty in even with Fight Club, because so much of it is pretty difficult to figure out how much is actually happening and what's sort of an illusion in the mind of the narrator. And this is hard for movies to make happen, right? I mean, this works well in books and in graphic novels, but movies have a hard time getting you in and out of somebody's head.
And I think that's why my books are very attractive to experimental filmmakers, because they're up for a challenge. They don't want to do just another job and get it done and get it out there. They want to tackle something that they can kind of reinvent the process with.
Chuck, what a great pleasure. Really good to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, maybe I'll see you at the bookstore.
Hope so. My guest is Chuck Palahniuk. He is he's just finished his graphic novel, Fight Club 2, going to be at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham this afternoon. You find out more about the book, about his visits, and any of his tour at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a Duke scholar talks about the importance of the selfie in the digital age. Stay with us.